Velkommen til Energi og klima som podcast. Mitt navn er Martin Hirt, og i dag så har vi en litt spesiell episode til dere. Jeg har snakket med Seb Henbest, som er sjefsøkonom i Bloomberg NEF, om deres energiscenario, energiutviklingen som sådan og mye annet. Den praten er naturlig nok på engelsk, men det er vi helt sikre på at dere kommer til å tåle. Så her kommer praten min med Henbest. Today it's our pleasure to welcome Mr. Seb Henbest, Chief Economist at Bloomberg NEF, to the podcast. Thank you for joining us, Seb.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about the future of energy, but before we kick off, I would like to hear your perspective on a slightly more current subject, and that is the UK list coming from Boris Johnson the other day about his 10 steps to achieve a green industrial revolution and to become the Saudi Arabia of wind power, as he was quoted in his op-ed in the Financial Times. Have you had the opportunity to get some perspective on his policy ideas?
I think a little. I've probably read as much as anyone else has, and less than others. I know roughly what he's announced and some of the key features. I think making an assessment of it is, you know, difficult without all the detail, but certainly, yeah, we can chat about it. My initial thoughts on it really are that, you know, this is all a step in the right direction. The challenge of decarbonizing the world economy is so significant that it's the wrong conclusion if every step forward is considered not to be a large enough step. I think that every step is a step, and it's tempting to look at the impact of some of the things that have been announced or the lack of detail and criticize that it's not enough. And ultimately, we know to get to 1.5 degrees, these net zero targets are so demanding that it's going to have to ratchet up over time and become more ambitious. But, you know, I think it's very hard to suggest that with the plan as outlined, that the UK is on anything other than a decarbonisation trajectory, probably slower than some countries, but definitely faster than others. And that should be sort of embraced and taken for what it is, which is a good step forward.
And that's a nice bridge into the topic of today, and that's the New Energy Outlook 2020. And for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the New Energy Outlook, could you just give a very brief introduction to what it is?
Yeah, the New Energy Outlook is Bloomberg NEF's long-term scenario analysis on the future of energy. So we go out to 2050. We have two main scenarios. The first is an economic transition scenario, and really this is a way of getting at the underlying economics of change. We strip out policy. We're not trying to build a scenario that reaches a certain conclusion. We're trying to understand where the current trends in technology take us sector by sector, country by country. And then on that, we can say, well, you know, if we're thinking about climate, is that fast enough? Where do we need to go faster? The second part of the outlook is a climate scenario that does ask that question. And it this year describes a clean electricity and green hydrogen pathway to get well below 2 degrees by 2050. There are lots of different pathways that are plausible, reasonable, and worth investigating. This year, we've just chosen that pathway. There is some logic to it, electrification being an important vector of decarbonisation and likely to be a lower cost vector of decarbonisation for a lot of sectors. But ultimately, you know, we'll do more investigating of different pathways and different configurations in sort of future iterations of the report.
Mm. I think it's very interesting that you've chosen that pathway this year, because it's very similar to the pathway that Norway is looking to take. And I'm sure we'll get back to that. But if we stay with the ETS scenario for a little while, one of the major headlines coming out of news agencies when you released the outlook was the impact of the coronavirus, where you estimated it has saved about 2.5 years of energy-related emissions, and at the level of energy-related emissions will never again reach 2019 level. Is that a result of long-term corona effects, an accelerated shift to renewables, or a combination that makes you predict that 2019 will be the top year for emissions?
Yeah, I mean, calling peaks is a bit of a fool's game, really, isn't it? I mean, you can only get it wrong. But we thought this year, that's what the data was showing us. We shouldn't back away from it. Let's embrace it and say it. I think we'll end up probably being wrong in lots of ways in the outlook because these pieces of work are always wrong to some extent. It's really understanding the dynamics and the directions of travel that is their value. But yeah, the coronavirus is interesting. I'm feeling optimistic that by the Northern Hemisphere summer of 2021, we might be something back to normal. Hopefully, fingers crossed. When we did the modeling, we had to make a call on what the economic impact of coronavirus might look like. We had some data showing the immediate shock, particularly for the transport sector, but across the energy economy, there was just less economic activity. And that meant there was less energy consumption. Industry probably fared best, but overall, we saw about when we did the numbers, we calculated about a 9% drop in emissions, and different sectors and different countries, depending on the shape of those economies, had different impacts. And we looked country by country, and built a set of assumptions around coronavirus and its impact. In a nutshell, we really described something looking like a W. Which had an initial phase. And then we thought, well, actually, this is with all the intervention and the lockdowns and summer coming in the Northern Hemisphere, we're going to get this bounce back in economic activity. And then there'll probably be something as winter comes around again. And that's really what we're seeing. So we're reasonably happy that some of the assumptions we had to make earlier in the year seem to have been playing out. We're not happy that they are in some ways, of course, but for the modelling, it seems to be reflecting reality. The question then is, well, what happens? Do you bounce straight back to business as usual, pre-crisis levels, and carry on into the sunset? Or is something changed? What we're not assuming is that the world is fundamentally different. People are talking about this moment as a reset, talking about it as, that we will never go back to our offices, that we'll end up working from our lounge rooms forever. I think that's probably not true. Across the economy, we're talking 12, 18 months, 2 years, getting back to pre-crisis levels in 2022, 23, 24, you need to reset a baseline. And when you reset that baseline, even if you return into trend, you've got an ongoing saving that's cumulative over the next 30 years. When we add that all up, sector by sector, it adds up to about 2.5 years worth of emissions at current levels, energy emissions at current levels. So we wait to be proved wrong on this because we're working in a very uncertain environment with coronavirus and what's going to happen next and how economies will recover. But if there's any silver lining here, it is that we maybe bought ourselves a little bit of time and perhaps a little more time than people initially may have thought.
You mentioned uncertainty, but something you seem a bit more certain of, it's the overall story of lots of new renewable capacity, increased efficiency and declining levels of cost. You had some interesting numbers with wind and PV being the cheapest source of electricity in three quarters of the world. And in those countries where it's not, the tipping point is near, do you see a continued development of higher efficiency and falling costs?
I mean, for PV is the best example in terms of the length of the data series. I mean, we've got data going back to the 70s, to the US space program, where we can see the cost decline of this technology with increased manufactured volume. And it's a silicon-based life form, These have the ability to improve the manufacturing and the efficiency. And that's a long storyline, and we know that from the semiconductor industry and similar manufactured industries, that if you keep volume of production going up in a competitive environment, you will get cost declines, and we're seeing the same sort of things. Renewables, particularly PV, but also wind and also batteries, though they're a bit more complicated, they're not quite as simple in a way, but they're very modular and much smaller. If you think of the power system of the past, it's large pieces of engineering. And we're talking multi-hundred megawatt power systems, gigawatt-sized power systems. You get a lot of energy at once. It takes years and years to build these things. And you can do, you get one hit at it, right? Of those 500 megawatts to a gigawatt of capacity, if you break that down into thousands and thousands of little pieces, all the same, like a solar farm or a wind farm of that size, or the aggregate of lots of smaller wind farms or solar farms, you've got a huge amount of manufacturing and learning by doing an innovation incrementally, making it cheaper. So I think that we're seeing now, as you said, across about three quarters of the world GDP, renewables are just now cheaper. They've been on these very steep cost declines. And we are very now much past the world in which renewables are expensive or a luxury, you've got to pay a premium for. Pretty much everywhere we look, this stuff's the cheapest new electricity. The question of how deep they go and how far they go is a really important one in the outlook. And we try and put some limits on that based around the particular nature of these technologies and the economics. But I think in terms of what we know and what we don't know, there's plenty of things we don't know. I think rates of change we don't know. Policy environments are difficult to project forward, of course. But some things we do know now, and we do know some technology stories. And these technologies don't get any worse. They only get better.
You put a limit at about 70 to 80% penetration in most markets, leaving 20 to 30% coming from other energy sources. And if you look among the fossil fuels, gas is sort of the winner in your scenario, with a drop in coal and oil, whereas the need for gas capacity stays on as a base load. And especially in Norwegian, from a Norwegian perspective, as a large gas producer, how is the trajectory for gas if we turn to the climate scenario? Would it still remain as a sort of quite large industry, or is the need for gas reduced in that scenario?
Well, it's a great question. I think gas has the advantage in the power sector of being able to be deployed in smaller plants that can complement a bulk cheap renewable system and help when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining and batteries can't bridge these sorts of gaps, because there might be long seasonal gaps, for example. So we say, well, actually, you know, gas is the cheapest option to do that in most cases, not everywhere, but in most cases. And some places have a different mix. But I think certainly for Europe, gas is the obvious choice. Overall, in the outlook, gas is the only fossil fuel that grows. And it pretty much grows because we've got this, you know, this role it plays in the power sector. Though the volume of gas consumed declines, the amount of gas capacity in the power system actually goes up. So you've got this weird situation where you're building more gas plants to help manage those seasonal extremes, but you're actually running them very, very rarely. And then you get paid for being available and running. And so, you know, there is this question of how do you pay for these assets. That's a secondary one for now. But so the gas story is one of decline, actually, in power. It actually grows in buildings and industry. So that's actually where you're getting a lot of gas growth. For the power sector and gas application there, when we have to meet steep climate targets, there's a choice to be made. And that choice will really determine whether natural gas, as we know it today, has a strong future or a weak one. And that is, well, how do you get emissions out of emissions out of gas by essentially changing your gas, sort of a fuel switch, if you like, to something completely different, to some green gas or green molecule? Or do you sequester emissions or somehow recycle the emissions that come from using that gas? Part of this is also that we're talking about, when we think about the renewables getting to 70 to 80%, that's just wind and PV, right? Renewables themselves get high. If you think about zero carbon and add nuclear where it's running and hydro, overall, we're getting higher than that. So the role of gas is relatively small. It might be that gas plays this role for a long time to come yet, because it's wise to do so. To get to zero emissions, you've got to do something with gas emissions. They're half as carbon intensive as coal emissions. They're not zero. So they're an okay stepping stone. But yeah, you've either got to sequester them or you've got to replace them. So I think that's the decision that countries are making. And we're seeing a lot of discussion right now, somewhat prematurely in a way, because this is a more distant problem. But we need to ramp up the capacity in the world economy to be able to choose to sequester or to replace, and we're both those options are far from being an economic reality right now.
Staying on the sort of the subject of gas, in the climate scenario, as you mentioned, you have a pathway of major electrification and green hydrogen to hold the carbon budget well below 2 degrees, and you use green hydrogen. And also, in a Norwegian perspective, we have a discussion of green versus blue hydrogen, natural gas with CCS. And as late as this week, there was a CEO level meeting with between the Prime Minister and the Oil and Energy Minister, and CEO levels from Equinor, Statkraft, etc., where there is a, I wouldn't say a tension, but there is a sort of division between those hydropower production companies like Statkraft, which you know, who wants to go green, and then you have Equinor with a natural gas, who wants to deploy that in hydrogen production. And perhaps stepping a bit away from the scenario, but what is your view on the green versus blue discussion in Europe, and based on the work you do at Bloomberg NEF?
Yeah, and I should have mentioned this in your last question. I was thinking of the role of natural gas sort of in direct end use, as opposed to being a sort of midstream sort of part of the hydrogen manufacturing process. I mean, it's tricky, right? Because you manufacturing hydrogen from natural gas is very carbon intensive. So if your objective is to use hydrogen to reduce emissions, on face value, that seems like a bad way to do it. But you've got other considerations here. One is that a perfectly reasonable pathway at this stage might be to sequester the emissions from that in production. If you're doing it at scale, you've got stationary point source emissions that are the best ones to deal with this sequestration pathway. And that might become viable. And certainly there is an argument to say that CCS could be the right vector of decarbonisation, both in hydrogen production, but also in other, you know, other parts of industry. It's possible. The other consideration is, it's all good and well producing hydrogen and saying, well, now hydrogen is the molecule, is the fuel that is going to complement all this electricity that we're kind of anticipating, but all the end-use machines are not running on hydrogen. You know, whether it's a boiler in a house, you know, we're thinking about piping hydrogen into a building to supply building heat and hot water. You know, all the infrastructure that requires a different level of engineering at the end use and the distribution in pipes and things. So you've got these questions of, well, if you want a hydrogen economy, you've got to do a number of things at once. You've got to work out the end use applications, as well as provide the hydrogen as a viable supply source. How you make that hydrogen has an emissions impact. So my personal perspective on this is that if you want a hydrogen economy, you need to build a hydrogen economy, and in time you need to clean your hydrogen up. And it could be that there is a stepping stone here, which is you start getting hydrogen into end-use applications, you start reducing end-use sort of, you know, tailpipe, if you like, or direct-use emissions in parts of the economy where electricity finds it hard to go, and then you transition away. And I think that's completely reasonable. And if we're too puritanical about this and go, well, only green hydrogen will do, I mean, one of the things we identify in the outlook is that, you know, producing the amount of hydrogen that we earmark as being a volume that would feed across the world economy in a way that reflects the hydrogen economy, about 24 to 25% of final energy, is 800 million tons of hydrogen. You need something on the order of 14 terawatts of dedicated wind and PV. I mean, that's vast in itself. So that is a whole set of secondary problems, which is, who's going to deploy all this renewables, right? Especially in high density, high population density countries. Are they now at a significant competitive disadvantage because they can't make their own hydrogen? Who's going to win that hydrogen game, right? Now, if you've got lots of hydro, like Norway and the Nordics, you have a game plan here that could work. You have a ready, pre-built, high energy density clean electricity that you could use. But ultimately, you know, it's not obvious to us that the wind and solar pathway is the best and the only pathway. You could have an offshore wind strategy to make green hydrogen. I mean, I don't think people call it green hydrogen because everyone's got a name for something, but you know, you use nuclear, it's still zero carbon hydrogen. So I'm going to call it green hydrogen. And you would need far less space, you know, but still this massive rollout in new nuclear. I think our numbers suggest you need 5 terawatts of nuclear plants, roughly. And that would, you know, that's 18 times more than all the nuclear plants currently running in the world today. So whatever way you look at it, hydrogen economy is a massive industrial change. And whether we go straight towards a zero emissions hydrogen economy or we take stepping stones to get there, the important thing is that ultimately the only point in doing it is to get to zero carbon. So that, you know, that endpoint kind of needs to be baked into the strategy a little bit.
Just a personal perspective on the production of hydrogen is that, as you mentioned, we in Norway have a lot of hydropower at a relatively stable production rate and cost as well. And I find it interesting that if you look at countries like Chile, for example, where they have a very cheap PV, they also look into hydrogen production. So I guess it's a question of, do you produce sort of, say, locally, and in the case of Norway, you have a large production and you perhaps export to neighboring countries, if that is going to be the sort of the winning model, or if you have huge production facilities in areas with extremely cheap PV that produces when the sun is up or when the wind is blowing, and then exporting over longer distances. But as you say, it's still a major shift, and I guess it's extremely difficult to say how the value chain will look 20 years ahead of time.
Yeah, I think you've got a couple of things going on. You've got some economics that are going to shape the answer to that question. And some of those economics are around the additional cost of transport and storage. So when we look at moving hydrogen around and storing it, it's actually that's material expenses. Producing it's one thing. And that's potentially, if you can tap into, say, cheaper and cheaper renewables and cheaper electrolyzers, that's a pretty good story in terms of ongoing cost declines and the potential emerging commercial viability of green hydrogen production. But then to get it where it needs to go, moving this stuff around is really expensive. Pipelines are by far the cheapest option. And so there you've got sort of, in many ways, you've got continental sort of markets that are more natural than shipping this stuff around the world, which is different to fossil fuels that do ship more easily, though, you know, oil more easily than gas. And then you've got storage, and storing hydrogen's expensive because it gets out, you know. And so, when we looked at it, I think salt caverns were by far the cheapest storage. And there's only certain parts of the world that have salt caverns of the sort of volume you might need. And you can manufacture caverns, and it adds a lot of cost. So I think there's a question of cost. I think it's going to be relatively, if we do this right, it'll be relatively cheap to manufacture hydrogen anywhere you've got, where you've got a cheap renewable source. So good sunshine, hydro. Where I'm from in South Australia, has a new hydrogen strategy, and it's all around the excess wind on the Eyre Peninsula, which is this very windy spot that actually exports wind back to the east coast of Australia through interconnectors when it's really, well, it's really windy. And this is considered to be a great competitive advantage in a future electricity and hydrogen economy. And so there's a state level strategy that might work, but you've got to always ask yourself the question of, just producing it cheaply is one thing. By the time it gets to its destination, is it still cheap? Is it still, does it still have competitive advantage? And I think that's where certain strategic plays on something like hydrogen are going to fail or win, is that whole value chain sort of delivery, production, delivery and use nexus, whether that's least cost or not. And I think that this is partly down to political will. If you can subsidize the evolution of this or the development of this sector hard enough and fast enough, you've got a chance of winning. But the biggest players have got the biggest chance of winning because they've got the most money. You've got to think that some of the bigger economies with the bigger strategies and the bigger pots of public money to throw at this are going to probably do better than the smaller ones.
And talking about money, it's a well-known fact that you need large investments to finance a green shift. I think you estimated between 78 trillion and 130 trillion dollars of new investment between now and 2050. How far off are we from, if you break it down into annual investments, how far off are we from those numbers today?
Quite a long way. I mean, I just haven't phrased it for you. I mean, there's roughly, and it goes up and down, it depends what you include, but there's roughly 300 billion invested in renewable assets or sort of renewable energy, clean energy year on year. And it has been around that sort of number for about the last 5+ years. And that's because you're getting increased volumes and costs coming down, and they're sort of playing against each other. So as the technology gets cheaper, it's cheaper to deploy, your capex is lower, you deploy more of it, and we're sort of hovering around that 300 mark. It's a bit up and a bit down depending on the year and what's going on in any particular countries. I mean, that range that I mentioned before of sort of 78 to 130, that includes all the renewables capacity you need to build out, not just for an electrified end-use economy in transport, so EVs and electrified transport, in buildings, so that's electric sort of heat pumps and electric heating, and industry, but also the grid. More renewables require more grid investment, some of which is just connection. You've got to connect more, because renewables are a smaller scale. There's more of them, so you're going to do more connections for the same amount of capacity. Those connections are smaller, and so they're cheaper, each connection, but overall you've got to do more of it, and you've got to reinforce the grid in different ways as you've got more flow coming in the network. So it includes that, and it includes the production of hydrogen and the storage and the transport, and the range captures that range of different decisions, from everything from manufacturing hydrogen with wind or with nuclear to storing it in salt caverns or canisters. That the whole thing is a big range for a reason. It's very uncertain. It adds up to about 3% of world GDP on average per year to 2050. I mean, that's, people talk about, it's always a single digit, it's always kind of low and it seems small, but it's quite a lot of money, right? So I think and this is all for, this hydrogen story is all for like 24%, 25% of total final energy. It's not 100% of final energy. So we really got to want to reduce emissions to do this. And I think the world does, and the costs of not doing so are high enough that there is a lot of momentum in this direction. And I think the advantage hydrogen has, and I'm not a hydrogen cheerleader because I think it's got a lot of barriers to the mass adoption that we're describing in this scenario, but it has an advantage is it can get everywhere. It can get into heavy transport. It can get into heavy industry. It can get into seasonal power. And a lot of other solutions, especially the CCS solutions, are no good for things on the move. So they're no good for transport applications particularly. And you've got bioenergy solutions that have a question about, at first, their sustainability and their emissions profile, depending on what you're choosing, but also the volume of availability and how much really we can deploy in any one place. And so you start to look to synthetic fuels and hydrogen as being the green molecules that could help power a zero carbon economy. And long way away, but still, it has a lot of applications and could play this really big role. But a lot of money needs to flow. And I think that's one of the conclusions we draw is, and it needs to start now. That scenario we build, that climate scenario with hydrogen, we start to deploy scenario hydrogen into end-use applications across the economy by around 2030, which is far too soon on a cost basis. I mean, the analysis we did earlier in this year said, we think that hydrogen gets competitive with natural gas on an unsubsidized basis by mid-century if we go fast. Mm. So we're talking about much quicker than that. And that's a real, in the next 10 years, we've got to do a lot of capacity building and a lot of people have to think it's the right pathway for, I think, this to come to fruition.
We're nearing the end of our conversation, but I have a final question before we sign off. The outlook is also a story about how we're in a hurry, as you just mentioned. We got to do a lot of things the next 10 years. But if you go back to the Biden election, the Johnson plan, you have other key nations like China, Japan, South Korea, and the EU implementing or suggesting rather ambitious goals of becoming carbon neutral in 2050 or 2060 in China's case, which is all positive, which are all positive news. But on the flip side, could it get too comfortable for current politicians to sort of set targets that are 30 years, 40 years ahead, where they will be no longer in office and most of them probably won't be alive either, that it might steal the necessary focus from the short-term work that needs to be done?
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things to consider around all the recent announcements. And I think, you know, we're now getting to a very large fraction, you know, if Biden's confirmed and does engage with a net zero ambition for the United States, we end up with majority of world emissions captured by net zero targets. And that is great. That is a step in the right direction. But I think we wrote this in the outlook, which is that the emissions pathway is as important as the target destination, because emissions are cumulative, which means that getting to zero in any one particular year is not actually what is a climate objective. That's a political objective. That sounds good. That's something you can sell. What matters is how you get there, because we can go sailing past 1.5 degrees, sailing past 2 degrees of warming, and still be at roughly zero emissions in 2050 if our rates of change are very slow for a while and then very fast. Because it's the area, if you imagine the curve of emissions coming down, it's the area under that curve that matters, and the shape of that line determines the area under the curve. So the next 10 years are pretty critical to get on track. Otherwise, we are really at risk of overshooting and not being able to get back. And in the outlook, we flag three things that matter a lot for the next 10 years. And they're very high level things, because the devil here is in the detail. And I totally agree that these are easy targets to announce. Anything that's 30 years hence is an easy, 40 years hence is an easy thing to announce. What's much harder is actually doing things to get there, especially with that long. It's like, you know, it's like you think back to university and doing an assignment. You've got 6 months to do it. I mean, you tend to do it in the last week, right? Everybody does that. It's very hard for humans to think and strategize long term and take the right step-by-step approach to getting to where you need to go. It tends to all happen in a hurry. And I think from climate, that's a real risk. And I suspect it will initially be something that's more likely to happen in a hurry than happen at the rate of change that we need. I mean, we calculated about a 10% emission reduction worldwide year on year, every year to 2050, to get to a trajectory consistent with 1.5 degrees warming by 2100. I mean, that's a significant change from business as usual. I mean, and that's not going to happen anytime in the next 5 years. Maybe we start to ratchet up in the back end of this decade. Ultimately, there are like a really hard choices, but I think there are some sort of no regrets things that we can start to do now to ease that transition and accelerate that transition. And we identified three. One of them is just this renewable story is an easy one. You know, if wind and PV are the cheapest generation, you just want more and more of it. You want more of your megawatt hours delivered at zero marginal cost by something that has a lifetime project cost of, you know, $30 a megawatt hour. You just do. It's cheaper than anything else out there. So you want to max that out and to accelerate the natural churn of assets. So there's lots of coal and gas plants running at the moment that are running megawatt hours by mid-decade. So by 2025-ish, give or take a few years, depending on the country, you get to a point where it's cheaper to build renewables than to run the existing coal or gas plants because the technology gets cheap enough. And I think that's the point at which you just need to accelerate and you need to get the old stuff out and the new stuff in. That's one thing. And everybody needs to go faster. The second one is that you've got a lot of the transitions that are emerging in transport and in buildings are consumer-led transitions. The electric vehicle revolution, if you want to call it that, is about people making different buying choices. And that's very different from large-scale asset infrastructure decisions. This is about people who are going to buy things based on a whole set of criteria. Price matters. So upfront subsidies can help, or lifetime cost of ownership subsidies can help. But ultimately, once you get a trickle of this turning into mass market, you can get exponential growth. And exponential growth is something that helps you keep on climate targets. So engaging the public in their consuming decisions, in terms of their choices of vehicles, making it easy to change, increasing charging infrastructure to make that addressable market for EVs larger and larger, encouraging people in warmer climates to deploy rooftop and small-scale PV system, which again, it's not the cheapest route, but it could be the fastest. You know, a lot of people can reduce their reliance on more carbon-intensive grid electricity that way. And even when we get to things like buildings, buildings are really difficult to decarbonize, and a lot of existing buildings are going to be a heavy lift. But one way to do that is to get people to, as they renovate or as they make choices about the next bit of technology they need, or as they replace old and aging boilers and furnaces, that they look at electric options, at low carbon options, and that is going to require policy intervention to drive that. And we're starting to see more and more of that. But if you can harness that consumer uptake, I think we have an opportunity to go faster in the next decade. We just got to make a decision and go for it. So the next 10 years really matter.
Thanks a lot, Seb. I'm sure we could have stayed on talking for quite some time, but we're running out of time. So I would like to thank you again very much for taking the time to speak to me. And I hope we can do this again next year with another scenario, and then perhaps meet in person in Oslo as well after the coronavirus has disappeared.
That'd be great. Sounds good. And thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thank you, Seb.
Tusen takk for at du lyttet på Energi og klima i dag. Intromusikken er laget av min kollega Håvard Skaugen. Har du tips eller tilbakemeldinger, send de til martin.hirt@energiogklima.no, og så høres vi senere i uken.